Hi, I'm Gary, and this is episode 205 of EV Musings, a podcast about renewables, electric vehicles, and things that are interesting to electric vehicle owners. On the show today, we'll be looking at climate change as we talk with a proper climate scientist. This season of the podcast is sponsored by ZapMap, the free-to-download app that helps EV drivers search, plan, and pay for their charging. Before we start, I wanted to welcome new Patreon member Philip Ashby. Thanks to you and all my patrons for your continued support. Our main topic of discussion today is climate. Back in episode 201, the first episode of this season, we spoke with carbon literacy trainer Anne Stelson. I asked her a couple of climate-related questions, and she made a great attempt at answering the questions, but I said at the time that I will be speaking to a proper climate scientist later on in the season to get chapter and verse on what's happening with climate and how worried we should be.
I'm Richard Allen, so I'm a professor of climate science at the University of Reading. So I do teaching, but also research involved in climate change.
There we go. A proper climate scientist. In the public discourse about climate, whenever there's a new record set for highest temperature or most rainfall or most flooding or severe droughts or wildfires or anything that a rational person would think out of the ordinary, the comeback from the deniers is, well, it's just weather. So what is the difference between climate and weather?
We all know weather. I mean, that's the, you know, what's out the window, what's happening, the here and now. Climate is kind of what you expect of the weather over a longer period. Weather is actually what you get in reality. So climate is a kind of your fingerprint of the expected conditions of, you know, rainfall, temperature, sunlight, cloudiness over a longer period of time. So it's quite different to weather, because with weather, you're looking to forecast what's going to happen at this particular location, at this particular time. Whereas with climate, you're looking at what will happen in terms of the statistics of the weather over a longer period.
The aim of all this research, discussion, and mitigation is all focused on one thing, eliminating or reducing carbon. Now, it's a fairly small element, and in the big scheme of things, it only accounts for 0.04% of all atmosphere. Now, to me, and indeed to many other people who don't understand these things, this would seem to be a minuscule percentage to have any sort of effect on global weather.
Yeah, well, small things can be extremely important. I mean, there's 420 parts per million by volume of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, as you say. There's probably about the same concentration as caffeine in your cup of coffee. So that tiny amount does all the work in terms of keeping you alert and making you ready for podcasts and things like that. So small things can be important. And it's obvious from all the physics that's known about carbon dioxide, which is a linear molecule. It does some very interesting vibrations that can absorb infrared radiation at a particular wavelength that happens to be right bang in the center of where a lot of the emission emitted out back out to space from the planet is going on. So that's our ultimate way that the planet can cool. It receives sunlight, and that incoming sunlight and absorbed sunlight is balanced by infrared emission out to space. And this carbon dioxide is impeding that flow of cooling. So meaning there's more energy coming in than leaving, and that's what's heating the planet up. So again, it's a nonsense argument, because the physics just shows that that amount of carbon dioxide in the air, or that rise in carbon dioxide in the air, it's risen from, say, 300 parts per million to 420 parts per million in the last 100 years. That is absolutely crucial in terms of driving current climate change.
Which then raises the next question around carbon. When I went to school, we were told that plants and trees needed carbon dioxide to live and survive. So given that the carbon in the atmosphere is increasing, why is that a bad thing? Surely more carbon means more carbon dioxide, which means greener, stronger plants. Carbon dioxide is good for plants, isn't it?
CO2 is good for plants. It is to some respects, but it's much, much more complicated than that, because plants obviously take in carbon dioxide through their stomata and use it to build stems, their roots, their leaves, etc. So there is known to be a fertilization effect where you raise carbon dioxide in the air and plants will grow more strongly in response to that, but only if there's enough nutrients, if there's enough water, if there's enough sunlight for photosynthesis. So in actual fact, it's not known whether in which type of plants or which region this fertilization effect will be actually significant, because stomata can either, which take in the carbon dioxide, they can either stay open and breathe in more carbon dioxide, or they can say, well, look, I've got enough carbon dioxide, so I'm going to close slightly because I want to retain the moisture. Moisture is lost through these stomata. So often plants actually become more water efficient at higher CO2 levels. So the overall bottom line is that, yeah, CO2 can be beneficial for some plants, not all plants, and in some regions, but the cost to the plants of more intense drought conditions, more intense heat, more intense precipitation, other changes in atmospheric conditions do far, far more damage to vegetation than the extra benefit from rising carbon dioxide levels.
I wanted to ask Richard about his thoughts on a couple of climate-related potential solutions that we keep hearing about in the press. So let's start with carbon offsetting.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical of carbon offsetting in the sense that you're almost paying someone else to do your reduction in emissions. I mean, really, it should be that everyone needs to do their bit by cutting emissions, by changing the way we live our lives to reduce emissions. And there will be situations where you can't do that, and there will need to be some kind of economic way, which I'm not an expert in, of course, of coming to the most efficient route towards collectively cutting greenhouse gas emissions. So if there is a need to do carbon offsetting, I think there's obviously healthy skepticism is required, because there's the opportunity for companies to jump on this bandwagon and say, you know, we're doing all this great, great stuff, but there's a lot of greenwash out there, I think. So you just need to do your research and check which kind of companies or which methods of carbon offsetting actually are effective. And maybe you focus in on the very few that I think are credible.
What about geoengineering, which is the practice of spraying chemicals into the atmosphere to create a sort of umbrella or mirror which will deflect heat back away from the planet?
The science of these geoengineering techniques is kind of known about, but practically nothing's been ever really trialed. And my viewpoint on it is it's a very bad idea indeed, because you can have really unforeseen consequences on, for example, the water cycle by introducing brightening clouds. You're essentially correcting for the fact that you're reducing the flow of infrared radiation out to space by increasing greenhouse gases. You're correcting for that with a completely different mechanism by actually reducing the amount of sunlight that's getting to the surface by brightening clouds. There have been studies showing that by introducing geoengineering in a simulation, you can get big changes in the water cycle. So what does that mean for politics? For example, if you did one country did some geoengineering and that made one other country drier, if they deemed it so, that could cause quite a lot of tension. So overall, I'd say it's important to research, and I hope we don't need to use any of these techniques, because they can be just as dangerous as the actual problem in the first place.
But in the big scheme of things, we've done geoengineering before, right?
Effectively, we're already geoengineering the climate by pumping vast quantities of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So we're already doing that. But yeah, like you say, I think that the research needs to be done on these kind of things, just in case. But let's hope we don't need to resort to these, you know, far-flung remedies for what is ultimately the need. Is if you've got too many greenhouse gases going up into the atmosphere, the best solution is to stop that happening, is to cut rapidly, massively across all sectors and in a sustained way, the amount of greenhouse gases we're pumping into the atmosphere. That is by far the most effective remedy for human-caused climate change.
I think what's also worth remembering is that all these changes are taking place, but they're not unusual for the planet. the Earth has been in situations where the temperature has been higher and the CO2 concentration has been higher, or where the temperature has been much lower and the CO2 temperature concentration has been lower. The planet has survived all these, and it will survive what happens if we don't mitigate the issues that we're facing today. But what won't survive is our ability to live on the planet. When the carbon dioxide and the temperature was as high as it is now, and even higher, back in far distant history, there were very, very few humans on the planet, and certainly not as many needing to live and survive on its dwindling resources. Those of you who've been on social media over the last few weeks will have probably seen a video by German theoretical scientist Sabine Hossfelder, who posited that we have about 20 years left on Earth due to the hot Earth model. What are Richard's thoughts on that?
So this kind of stems from work that's been done over the last decade, maybe by Jim Hansen. So people might recall Jim Hansen was a famous climate scientist. So he brought things up in the 1980s that this was a big problem. We need to do something about it. And he's a very extremely credible climate scientist, very impressive guy. Now, he's come up with some research recently that is, he's using some of the ancient records, for example, that I talked about earlier in the podcast, to suggest that actually the climate is more sensitive than we think it is. So for each progressive rise in CO2, their research thinks that the amount of warming you get is more than is currently estimated by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So what I'd say to that is that, you know, their papers have shown that it's a potential, it can't be ignored, but the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has done a very robust assessment of this already, and they find that the hot models, the models that are more sensitive, are actually less realistic in representing present-day conditions of cloud and other processes. So the IPCC assessed that particular range for how sensitive the climate is. And it's still quite a big range. So at the upper end of that range, we can still be expecting a very substantial amount of climate change. I'm still skeptical about the hot model problem. And it's also important to stress that you give the impression that we're basically stuffed, that in 20 years' time, you know, there's no going back, because it's not the case. Every bit of warming avoided is beneficial, because even if we can't keep the climate to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, which is one of the thresholds set at the Paris Climate Agreement, so below 2 degrees C is needed, preferably 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial, we want to limit the climate change to. Even if we exceed these barriers, every bit of avoided, if we can avoid 3 degrees C of warming and keep to 2.5 degrees C of warming even, that is a huge, huge benefit for society, because the consequences are so dire of going much above 2 degrees C above pre-industrial that every bit that we can do, every bit of action that we can avoid future warming and limit future climate change is doing a huge amount of benefit. So the hot model problem, in summary, I think, is not as likely as they're making it out, as some scientists are making it out to be, at our current understanding. And even if this is the case, every bit of warming avoided is going to be massively beneficial to human societies and the ecosystems on which we all depend.
I've got to say that when I look through social media and see some of the output coming from both lay people and scientists, it does fill me with a sense of existential dread. Richard, are we too late to do anything?
No, it's not too late, because any bit of warming avoided is going to benefit us massively. The recent warming is basically consistent with what all the simulations, all the lines of evidence suggest we can expect from the amount of greenhouse gases that we are pumping into the atmosphere. The last year was very unprecedented, very surprising in the way that the warming occurred, because we knew it was an El Nino year, which is basically where it's a natural fluctuation that occurs every 2 to 7 years, and you get a massive warming over thousands of kilometers of the eastern Pacific, and then that translates to a global increase in temperature of maybe a tenth or 0.2 of a degree Celsius in perhaps the following year. But last year, 2023, was really surprising because although El Nino was starting to take shape, other parts of the ocean were at unprecedented levels of warmth. So the Atlantic, the North Pacific. So there was something else going on last year that was interesting. What we're also seeing is an increase in the rate of climate change, which isn't unexpected from our expectations from simulations or the lines of evidence that we look at. So we're seeing an acceleration of sea level rise. We're also seeing there's this imbalance between the amount of sunlight absorbed and the amount of infrared radiation going out to space. There's more energy arriving than leaving. That's what's driving climate change. That's expected. We need to get that to zero, essentially, to stop climate change. But actually, that imbalance is increasing at the moment. We're seeing an increase in this imbalance in energy, again, a sign that climate change is accelerating rather than declining or becoming smaller. And there are some surprising results coming out in terms of how that's happening, how clouds are changing. So there's a lot of research going on in looking at, you know, what is going on over the present. That's what, you know, scientists like to do. They're looking at the surprising things and trying to explain them. So in summary, yes, things are changing rapidly, but mostly it is going along what we expect to be happening for the rises in greenhouse gases. And the only way we can impede this and actually limit climate change is by massively cutting greenhouse gases.
One thing that always puzzled me is the fact that for global warming or climate change, there's a huge cohort of scientists who studied the data, run the experiments, check the models, and come to the conclusions that this is a major man-made issue. But there's also a small cohort who've done the same thing and come to the conclusion that it isn't really an issue. But there's also a small cohort who've done the same thing and come to the conclusion that this isn't really an issue. How do you explain this apparent dichotomy? Why do some scientists not agree with the majority?
Well, I mean, the vast majority of climate scientists do agree to as much as scientists do, because scientists are quite abrasive people sometimes. They like arguing, but the vast majority of scientists are all in absolute agreement that human activity is pumping CO2 into the atmosphere. That's warming the planet. And unless we do something about this very rapidly and in a very, very big way, we're going to have a very dire future. The few scientists that don't, I mean, scientists are human beings, of course. We all have biases. One of these, for example, is confirmation bias, where, you know, you build up an opinion on something, whether it's from reading stuff, from doing stuff, experiments yourself, and then it's quite difficult to change your mind on that. That's the human nature. So I think you do get a few situations where some scientists go down a rabbit hole where they're attached too much to one particular viewpoint and they find it very difficult to change. There are a few of those that, not very many at all, who perhaps are skeptical on some aspects of climate change being caused by humans. But almost all these scientists who aren't perhaps conventional in their views on human-caused climate change do, the credible ones all know that, you know, climate is changing, humans are causing it. They're just disagreeing on the fringes of this. For example, how hot is it going to get? How important is it going to be? So, yeah, I don't really see that as an issue.
A little while back, Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything, did an episode which discussed academic fraud in publishing. It's a great episode. There's a link in the show notes. Basically, it posited that career advancements in academia are a direct result of posting research papers and good, interesting research papers at that. There's thus an incentive for academics to ensure that papers they publish are both frequent and stand out or unusual. And this resulted in a paper in the behavioral science sphere, which proved through data that signing a legal declaration at the top of the paper would provide more truthful answers than signing the same paper at the bottom. Now, this was a great piece of research, which unfortunately it was discovered to not actually be supported by the full data used to come to that conclusion. If the full and actual data had been used, this would have resulted in a standard, non-sensational paper, which wouldn't have provided any sort of career boost to those involved. That paper, alongside 10,000 others in the year, was retracted. But it does highlight the dangers of cherry-picking data, analysing and interpreting results to fit a predefined narrative, and generally committing quote-unquote fraud to move your career along. Richard, how comfortable are you that this isn't happening with climate research?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. I mean, again, going back to what I mentioned earlier, the vast, vast majority of scientists get into science because they're interested in the subject, they want to learn more. You're right that in every career that you need to do well to progress. You need to publish papers. It's not about publishing as many as possible. It's about publishing the best papers you can. It's about making yours a credible name based on measured kind of solid studies so that you can actually get funding for your research, so you can win, lead projects and things like that. But it's also about doing a bit for the university and, you know, communicating stuff and doing external stuff, being on committees and things like this. So it's not all about just publishing lots of papers. It's a whole different bunch of things that, you know, you need to be good at as an academic to progress in your career. And I don't see that it's a particular issue, academic fraud in the climate science area. I mean, you certainly get papers retracted. Sometimes they're honest mistakes. Scientists do work. It's found later on that there was some error in the method or some error in the data that hadn't been spotted earlier. And you have to say, well, yeah, we're going to have to retract this paper, or at least say, well, this paper isn't as reliable as was previously thought. So that's one aspect. We are actually manipulating numbers. I think that must be a tiny, tiny fraction of anything that's going on. So again, my viewpoint is that almost all scientists are going into their field because they're interested in the subject. They have no motivation for engaging in fraudulent activities. They may not be, they're human beings, so they won't be perfect. They'll make mistakes, that kind of thing. But fraud, I don't see as a major issue, particularly in climate science.
It's tempting to think that a lot of scientists sit in their ivory tower and don't actually produce results that people can really use. How do you let people know that this is something that's important to you and about which you are passionate?
Well, one, climate change is fascinating. It's an amazing topic. It brings together all the physics and biology and chemistry and you know, on its own, it's a fascinating topic. But I think what I need to, the main thing I'd like to get across is the fact that we've built up all this amazing amount of interesting science and shown we've got a problem. We know that humans are the cause of the problem, but we also know there's a solution to it. And I think on a positive note, we can see that there's a huge amount of activity amongst companies, universities, like the University of Reading is doing a lot, for example, to get to net zero, local groups, individuals. There's a huge amount of activity and collaboration going on now to embrace the fact that we can live in a better planet by living with much more efficient energy systems and taking a bit more care of the planet. And the other thing is the fact that many smaller institutes and companies and businesses are being very innovative, and they're actually leading governments. And there's a good reason for this, because governments are impeded by the fact of there's an electoral cycle. They've got to get enough voters. If they don't get enough voters, then they can't enact the policies they want to make. So you've got to be pragmatic in government. You've got to get into power before you can actually then make these good decisions. So the other aspect is really everyone needs to talk about climate change. You need to engage in the fact that what are governments, you know, what are the policies that different parties are coming out with? And it's about thinking very carefully about who you are electing, really. So the electoral cycle is important, but also just the positive aspect that we can do something about this problem. People are already doing things about this problem in a really innovative way. And we've got the potential to live in a much better future, a much more equitable future in terms of not just climate change, but also biodiversity and the fact of equity across society.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion. I think you'll agree. A couple of takeaways as far as I'm concerned. While it's tempting to listen to the doomsayers amongst us, there's always hope when it comes to climate change. So you should do whatever you can to reduce the carbon you produce. Use your vote wisely to put in power the right people to solve this crisis. If you need a hint, listen back to episode 201 at the start of this season, where we talk with Anne Snelson about carbon literacy. Second, beware of those trying to sell you a snake oil solution for climate change. There are those, primarily in the fossil fuel industry, who are pushing things like carbon capture and geoengineering. These are solutions which are known and established, but about which there are still huge questions regarding efficacy and scalability. The same with carbon offsetting. Finally, when someone comes up and says, carbon isn't that important, it's less than 0.05% of the atmosphere, remind them that it has the same concentration as caffeine, but is far more dangerous. I think that was a great discussion with Richard, and I'd like to thank him for coming on and spending some time. This season, we're looking at raising the awareness of carbon literacy with our listeners. One way we're doing that is with Carbon Fact, as read by carbon literacy trainer Anne Snelson.
Over 30% of the world's food supply is actually wasted, and most of it goes in landfill where it releases methane. So if you're storing away food, please start planning better and buy a bit less. If you've got food going off, why not bulk cook and freeze it? That will help you save it for another day.
It's time for a cool EV or renewable thing to share with your listeners. Now, I know we've just talked about carbon capture, saying it's proven technology, but there are questions around the efficiency. But I wanted to talk about Seaboard. Now, they're a London startup with a simple proposition. Take marine vessel exhaust plumes, so things from marine freighters and container ships and oil tankers. Pass that exhaust through calcium oxide, otherwise known as quicklime, and use the reaction to create calcium carbonate or limestone. They've just finished running prototypes on board a large marine vessel, and they're refining the process to get it more and more efficient. But at the moment, they reckon they can convert 78% of the carbon from the vessel's exhaust, and they're aiming for up to 98% conversion. Now, the beauty of this process is that quicklime as a product can be purchased for about $200 per ton, but the resulting product, limestone, can be sold for almost four times that much. So it's actually a profitable thing to do. Now, of course, it's not quite as straightforward as I've made it sound, because the quicklime has to be loaded onto the ships, and the limestone, when created, is heavier, and it takes up quite a lot of storage space. One calculation has shown that the apparatus and the materials could take up to 20% of the ship's gross tonnage, which is not ideal. But the principle is sound, and it's another one to keep an eye out for. The EV Musings podcast is sponsored by Zapmap, the go-to app for EV drivers in the UK, which helps our EV drivers search, plan, and pay for their charging. Zapmap is free to download and use, with subscription plans for enhanced features such as using Zapmap in-car, on CarPlay, or Android Auto. And that's the show for today. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. If you want to contact me, I can be emailed at info@evmusings.com. I'm also on Twitter at MusingsEV. If you want to support the podcast and the newsletter, please consider contributing to becoming an EV Musing patron. The link is in the show notes. Don't want to sign up for something on a monthly basis? Well, if you've enjoyed this particular episode, why not buy me a coffee? Go to coffee.com/EVMusings and you can do just that. ko-fi.com/EVMusings. Takes Apple Pay too. I have a couple of ebooks out there if you want something to read on your Kindle. So, You've Gone Electric is available on Amazon worldwide for the measly sum of 99p or equivalent, and it's a great little introduction to living with an electric car. If you're looking for installing solar panel storage, battery and a heat pump, try So You've Gone Renewable, also available on Amazon for the same 99p. And if you've got Amazon Prime and you can use the Kindle lending library, you can read them for nothing. Why not check them both out? Links for everything we've talked about in the podcast today are in the description. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe. It's available on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave a review. It helps raise our visibility and extend our reach in search engines. If you've reached this part of the podcast and are still listening, thank you. Why not let me know you've come to this point by tweeting me at MusingsEV with the words, "You're a scientist." #ifyouknowyouknow, nothing else. Thanks, as always, to my co-founder, Simon. You know, when he was at school, he worked out in a physics class how to get cold fusion working at room temperature. Sure, he needed some pretty hefty power inputs, and he wasn't really welcomed by the fossil fuel majors when he proposed it. But that wasn't the reason he stopped developing it. It was the people he was dealing with in the labs.
Because scientists are quite abrasive people sometimes. They like arguing.
Thanks for listening. Bye.